And of course, this hour we'll take your calls with Jacob Cooper, author of Life After Breath, when we come right back on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back. George Norrie with you. Jacob Cooper with us. Again, his websites are linked up at coasttocoastam.com, and we'll take your calls this hour. Jacob, do you think you needed the near-death experience in order to do what you're doing today?
Certainly it was helpful. I think, you know, what really allowed myself to change from the near-death experience where, you know, as a kid, I had this experience, and I think in order to survive, I just almost needed to push it away, but it was always there in the background, kind of like a beach ball that you try to push underwater, but eventually it would come up, and I think to thrive, I needed to learn how to make sense of it. But I think the near-death experience isn't something that I just needed, but I think, you know, we're all connected, and I think you go through things to hopefully have a ripple effect on others. And I don't think it's anything that you go through is within vain or just for your own, you know, egocentric purposes. It's for others. And so I think this really wasn't just so much about me as it was more so for other people, you know, to hopefully be changed and shifted from this experience that just came through me but not from me.
Do you believe that most people who have near-death experiences come back with a profound understanding of why we're here in the first place?
I think that's the hope. I think they might have a little bit more of an insight. Within my work, I never have anything close-ended other than, you know, key areas. But I think every day, you know, is a different way to have it. And I think, you know, why I say that is, you know, everyone asks what the meaning of life, but I love the quote that it's to give life meaning, and I think every day is another opportunity to find meaning in a sense of ways to look at it in a higher way and to expand and evolve and grow, and that's infinitely possible within each day. And I try to take one day at a time and try to, you know, make the most of each day. But I think in general, people have more specific understandings of some of their dharma, some of their purpose, and what ripple effect they could create from their own power and their own path and their own blueprint that was charted before they got here, you know, within their lives.
Did your experience make you any more spiritual or religious than you were?
Well, from, you know, afterwards, absolutely, I was a lot more connected. I wouldn't say religious. To me, religion is, you know, God outside of you, or spirituality is the inner awareness, is the inner connections, for more of a personal connectivity. So I would say absolutely there's transformation behind it, you know, that I experienced. But it really allowed me to look at the world in a much different way. You know, I was removed from the body, from the physical world, and I was just reminded myself that I am not this body, but I'm temporarily in this body. And it just reminded me of who I was, that, I was not this body, you know, but rather an eternal being. And it just was a reminder of what I already knew, but for God. And, you know, I think I love what Plato talked about, where certain people drink a little bit less from the waters of forgetfulness of our own, you know, nature and our own eternal understanding. And near-death experiences allow us to really have a lot more recall of who we truly are, not what we are. If that makes sense.
Jacob, I know earlier you mentioned that time really doesn't mean much on the other side, so whether you were 3 or 80, it didn't matter. But in your life today, had you had a near-death experience, let's say at 30 or 31, would you have been able to understand things more in a different way when you came back?
Well, I think in a way it had a lot, that would have a lot of pros and cons to it. I think, you know, being, it's hard to say what I was today. If I was just totally, you know, disconnected and had that experience, I would have followed like a similar trajectory where others, where I think the near-death experience, much like, you know, any other experience, if you look at the Buddha, let's just say, you know, in order to find yourself, you have to lose yourself or be willing to. And the near-death experience, you know, when people transform, they lose a part of what they, you know, define themselves as or define the nature of reality as, and they allow themselves to unfold to a new one. And so I think at any age, is there an opportunity, you know, from the position of losing yourself and a part of your identity to allow yourself to have a greater unfoldment of the nature of reality is something that's applicable. But I think it was much more difficult because in a sense that, you know, I just almost saw the world in a topsy-turvy way where the young was old and the old was young, so to speak. And, you know, after that experience, I wasn't able to look at adults or people in a, you know, in a different way. And, you know, it just, it was hard because I think there's a lot of physical dependence that we have as children on adults, and that leads itself to dependence in thought at times, or dependence in, you know, just their nature of reality. But I think they're coming from the world view; they're not coming from the spirit view. And you know, as a child, sometimes we're disempowered, we bog down our connection and our awareness to be in our own backyard, and we get disempowered, and we put it in the hands of those around us and the world in front of us. And so, I think the issue is a lot of people live their lives from the outside in versus the inside out, and the near-death experience allowed me to really beat to my own drum and connect to something inside of me as a higher value than the truth, you know, in front of me, if that makes sense.
Let's go to the phones now. Jeremy in North Dakota to get us started. Hello, Jeremy.
Hello, George. I've had a near-death experience that I've dealt with for well over 17 years.
You sure did. You were in that coma, too, weren't you?
Yep. I was driving my Kia Rio up an icy hill. A Ford pickup started to slide down the hill at me. The Ford hit my Kia Rio head-on, and I was immediately in a coma for 2.5 months.
Now, tell us about the near-death experience, what you might recall.
What I recall from when I was in my coma is I was dreaming that I was walking up a mountain pathway with my wife at the time. And all of a sudden, a bunch of boulders started falling down the mountain towards us, and I pushed her in a crevice on the pathway, and then the boulders knocked me off the cliff. And as I was falling from the cliff, I heard a voice say, "Jeremy, your tasks are not done yet."
What do you think this was, Jacob?
It seems to me like an incredible transformative experience, and you know, in an NDE. You know, I think, you know, obviously there's researchers who set criteria, you know, but and it's important to have that overview. But I think internally we know we're able to understand what we had of our own subjective basis, and there's no one that could tell you otherwise, you know, in a way. And so I think trusting your gut as to what your experience was, and I'm glad that you're still here. And it's a very small percentage of people who are having this. I mean, obviously, I think it's growing because of the current, you know, health situation, but it's maybe 5 to 10% of the populations that are having this. And but the ripple effect of these small percentages is profound. And, you know, I think the important part is to not be defined by your story, but to learn how to define it and learn that it's not just here for us to hold on to in a book to collect dust on a bookshelf, but rather, and it could be literally a book, but rather something that is meant for other people to hear in their own unique way and their own unique time, if that makes sense. But thank you for sharing on the airways.
Do you recommend, Jacob, that most people get a past life regression therapy session?
Timing is everything. You know, I think when there's a readiness, I can't say it's a one-size-fits-all, you know, George, but I think everyone could certainly benefit from it, because I think, you know, the biggest question that people have is, what is my life's purpose? And I think so many people come out of their lives from a very limited standpoint. They're not coming from the deeper depths of their own inner being. And you know, most people live life from the outside in versus the deeper place of the inside out. And so, you know, past life regression is so profoundly, you know, healing for people from a multitude of levels. But I think the utmost level would be to obviously understand the eternity of the soul, but also to truly understand our own dharma, our own purpose, and to understand our own infinite power within ourselves that sometimes we lose. And in our world, there's a very conditional response to identity. We're programmed that way. If we get the good grade, we feel good about ourselves. And so, you know, that's how we're kind of programmed, where once you go and you have past life regressions, you're able to understand we live many lives, die many deaths, but we turn back to unconditional love, which loves us for who we are and not what we are, if that makes sense.
First-time caller JT is with us in Pekin, Illinois. Hello, JT. Thanks for calling.
Well, hello.
Hi there. Go ahead, sir.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a few questions.
All right.
One, meaning, how does one take the act of suicide and then transform it into that purpose that you are giving forth right now? How do you go through that motion?
All right, let's take the first one. Go ahead, Jacob.
I just have to ask, is this from someone who lost someone to suicide or someone who had an attempt?
Yeah, I've lost someone.
My sincere condolences go out to you. You know, I just lost one of my best friends to that as well, too. So I join you in pain, and I thank you for obviously sharing, you know, that, and you have, you know, admirable strength. I would say it's becoming, you know, increasingly, you know, growing as, you know, challenges are there. I think in our own unique way is to understand that as much as we love someone, we don't control their actions. We try to influence that, but we don't control it. And I think there's a lot of guilt that happens, you know, through it. And I think it's important to understand that it is, at the end of the day, a decision, you know, that a soul makes. From a broader standpoint, you know, we're used to passing judgment. And I think truly in every person's situation, their own unique circumstances, they're doing the best that they can. From our vantage point, it might look a little bit differently. But I think once you do cross over, there's a profound healing, a profound transformation. And if we do believe that we're a part of God, how could God reject its source? I think really when people are going through this, it's subjectively different case to case, but I think it's really a separation from the truth of what we are, and there's a disconnect. And crossing over within our due time, we're able to connect back to that. And so I think it's common. I think the helpful thing is to let go of any responsibility or guilt that we have over that, recognizing that the souls that we have can never be separated from us, that love truly never dies, that the body is not who we are and what connects us, but rather something much more. And to understand that, you know, we don't end from that one chapter. There's a continual unfoldment and a continual growth that happens. And I find that people who cross over, who do commit suicide, you know, it's almost kind of like we have to go through something to understand something, and they work many times within a soul group on the other side, you know, with other people who have had suicide. And so we're infinitely connected with love, but also within purpose. And many times people who do that, they do grow, they do evolve, they do understand that, and they are able, from that period that they went through and the experience that they went through, they're able to have a deeper sense of understanding to those on the earth plane what they're going through to guide them. But obviously, processing your own emotions within your own time, you have the right to feel what you feel, but I think what you feel will allow you to heal. And I think it's very important to feel that and to be able to process it in your own unique way and to let go of any responsibility, guilt of that, and to understand that your souls belong to God. They don't belong to this earth plane. And, you know, there is no time on the other side, and we eventually go back to the eternal ocean of love. We just have our own currents that we have within each carnation, but eventually we always go back to it, and, you know, things even out within time. All I do believe is well, was well, will be well in the broader perspective, if that makes sense.
Let's go back to JT for a second question. Go ahead, JT.
I was going to say, everything that he said was absolutely beautiful, and I can't disagree with any of it.
Perfect.
But the meaning of life is to give life meaning. That's another thing that I have a little bit of a discrepancy with, because there was always meaning.
Well, there should be, don't you think, Jacob?
Yes, and, you know, it's like it's very hard to find people who are agents of change who haven't experienced the dark night of the soul. It might not be there for you here today within this, but I think with every situation, there's a possibility to allow ourselves to transform, as Deepak Chopra would say, to transform our karma, the story, into our dharma, into our purpose. And so I think with you, with going through this, you have an immense potentiality, you know, to really transform, you know, darkness back to its eternal truth. And I think that that's there, but I think within our own way, each and every day, we could find that glimpse of eternity. We could find that moment. It might not be at a consistent basis, but we're able to find ways to pivot and go back to that. And so I think having a near-death experience doesn't immunize myself from some of the human stuff, but having this experience has a clear knowing that no matter what happens, I'm always able to go back to that foundation, and that foundation is who I truly am, you know, what not what I am or what I'm experiencing or what's temporarily turbulence. I think turbulence is a part of a lot of people's identity versus the eternal connectivity to truth and light itself, if that makes sense.
Let's go to Walter in Pennsylvania, east of the Rockies. Walter, go ahead.
Hi, George. George, whenever I hear of people that claim they had a near-death experience, I told Tom I think of the guy that sat up in his casket in the old E.F. Hutton commercial. I think that's the guy we ought to talk to, George. That's true. George, with all due respect to Mr. Cooper, I think that the critical word in near-death experience is the word near. Now, you may be near death, but technically, you're still alive. You can recover from a flat EKG, but not recover from a flat EEG. I think that these near-death experiences are actually life experiences at a subconscious level.
Well, they're on the fine line, Walt. There's no question about that. But I'll give you a chance to quickly react to that, Jacob.
Yes. I think near-death experience put the mind and the brain in different categories. I mean, obviously, through my experience, my brain was not working, but there was a whole part of awareness that happened. And so from the consciousness that's produced by the brain that, you know, conventional wisdom tells us, if the brain is not working at all or if it's barely functioning, my awareness should match that. And so I think to have profound awareness with the brain not working puts the brain and the mind in two different categories, I would say. But obviously, I can only plant my seed. I can't, you know, enforce a belief system. I really value your own belief system, and you obviously keep us honest. So, you know, do appreciate that. But I think it's important to really look at the brain and the mind and how people are, you know, the brains are not working. Not just near-death experiences, but let's say hallucinogenics. The brain activity is usually a lot slower, but yet their awareness is much higher. And so how does that work? Or people who have Alzheimer's or, you know, dementia, you know, for them having these you know, deathbed visions when they're about to go and the brain activity is much lower for their awareness to be much higher. And so I think there's not a lot of answers to that. I mean, obviously the question is posed, but for those particular situations, the answers are not there. How that's possible if the brain does produce consciousness, how do we have these profound, you know, awarenesses? And people to have, you know, like let's say someone that I knew of, you know, had a near-death experience. She was just in a hospital, and she had this awareness of a tennis shoe that was on the roof of the hospital. And she didn't take like a plane or a droid up there, whatever, you know what I'm saying? And she was just in a hospital bed. So to have this profound awareness, you know, what is that and how is that, you know, humanly possible and where does that come from? So there's a lot of questions that need to be looked at a closer way, but I do appreciate you bringing that up and keeping us honest. Thank you.
Jacob, give out your website if you would.
My website is www.jacoblcooper.com. That's jacoblcooper.com.
You got to put that L in there, right?
Yeah. Jacob Cooper is not available, so plenty of people type that in. And fortunately, L is, you know, L is my middle name, which in Hebrew it means lab, which means like the heart of the lion in a way.
Okay, we're going to come back and take final calls with you in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. On our next Coast to Coast program, Mark Shaw joins us to talk about why they refused to release JFK documents. It's an amazing story. And then Maren Mutter joins us to talk about inside past life connections on Coast to Coast. Make sure you're part of the program. And welcome back to Coast. George Norrie back with our final segment with Jacob Cooper, author of Life After Breath. And what's the name of the new book that you're working on, Jacob?
Yeah, not official, but I'm teetering with the name of The Wisdom of Jacob's Ladder.
The working title, right?
Yeah, yes, that's the term, yes. The Wisdom of Jacob's Ladder is the book that I'm nearly completed with, so, yeah.
Let's go to John, truck driving in Indiana. Welcome to the show. Hi, John.
Good morning, gentlemen. I tell you what, I love the show. You keep us going on the road out here, stimulating our minds.
Well, thank you, and thanks for keeping America going, John.
Thank you. Thank you. My question is, it's like a two-parter. Why is it when you, if you regress someone, we never seem to get anyone famous? I know there's a lady here that says she's Cleopatra, but why don't we get anyone famous? And then my second one would be even more, you triggered my mind. Wouldn't it be good to transgress somebody like Putin or Ching or Kim Jong-un and see if maybe they have someone like a Chairman Mao or a Hitler or someone or a Mussolini trying to come back to finish what maybe they failed at?
Interesting questions. What do you think, Jake?
Well, yeah, I think, you know, passive aggression is a form of hypnosis, so they would have to be very open to this. And usually a lot of those names that you're describing are pretty dark entities, and so they, it's pretty hard for the dark entities to be open, you know, to the light at times or to be open to this work. But it would be interesting. It's funny that you mentioned Cleopatra, because I had the exact opposite experience. When I do regressions, a lot of people do think that they're Cleopatra, and some of my colleagues will ask, okay, which one were you? Because I think there were like six or seven of them, you know, meaning that, you know, a lot of us have a desire to be someone famous. I think at the end of the day, when you cross over on the other side, you recognize that we're all famous to each other. We all know each other. There's no one who, you know, is in a way superior. I think there's higher octaves, there's higher energies of, but we're all just expressions of divinity. But, you know, it's interesting. I haven't got crossed it within my own experience as someone with fame, but I think fame is very much a human construct. You know, on the other side, it's we all really understand that we truly know each other, and hopefully we'll be able to remember that within this lifetime, that we are all our brothers and sisters' keeper, just, you know, here playing in God's playground. And I experienced that in my near-death experience, a child playing, in, you know, a young boy playing in the playground, you know, and I think that was an allegory for life itself, that we're all just trying to figure it out, and we're all here to take care of each other, and you'll come from the same place, and, you know, there's no hierarchy, really, on the other side. We're all, you know, just a part of the collective, in a way. But it should be interesting. You know, I haven't seen it yet. I certainly will, you know, try to do it. But, you know, there's been actually a story of a child who remembers his life as Lou Gehrig, come to think of it. And, you know, as a young child, there's a lot of things that he knows that not a lot of people are privy to. And just the way that he swings and just his obsessiveness with Lou Gehrig and the understanding of the beef that he had with Babe Ruth. And whenever he was a very young kid, there was a picture shown of Babe Ruth, and he got very upset. And it was known that Lou Gehrig and Babe Ruth did not have a very good relationship. Babe was not very nice to Lou Gehrig. But, you know, that's one that I remembered, just in terms of a boy who was well-known and remembered that life. And, you know, obviously, it's University of Virginia has a lot of different case studies that, you know, we could look into regarding people who are famous, and being able to look at some of the different case studies and evidential, you know, viewpoints and findings of those. But it is an interesting point. Thank you.
Sure is. Let's go to Renee in Ventura, California. Welcome to the show. Hi, Renee.
Hi, George. Thanks for taking my call.
You're very welcome.
Thank you, Renee.
I have had a grandson who was murdered in November, on November 12th in 2018. I've been trying to communicate for a while because the police have dropped the case. It's now a cold case, and even though it's not even quite 3 years, but I've been trying to communicate. I've asked our Lord for help in this. I know my grandson saw who murdered him. He and a friend, his friend lived, he didn't. They were walking from after work at 11. He died at 11:01. And I'm trying to find out who did it. I've asked God, I've asked him. How does one go about, unless I have a session, and the police can't help or won't help?
Sounds like more of a job for a medium, Jacob. What do you think?
Yes, and, you know, please do reach out to me privately, because I have a listing of evidential mediums. They're mediums and those that are scientifically tested. I know one organization that I have presented for, it's called the Forever Family Foundation, you know, tests, you know, different mediums, and there's different, you know, other programs, you know, that do test mediums, you know, because, you know, grief is very important. We do want to make sure that it's someone who is evidentially tested, you know, and is clear and credible. But I think within frequencies, if we're going through grief, if we want something so badly, It's kind of like the frequency of the other side is very high, and our grief is, you know, heaviness, and we're, you know, blocked in what, you know, kind of what we want. So it's hard in us for, in a way, to connect. So do reach out to me privately through my website, and I could recommend through my own listing, you know, of evidential mediums that I could highly recommend if you are interested within timing, you know, of that message for you.
All right. Joe in Monterey, California is with us now. Hi, Joseph.
Thank you for taking my call, George.
Sure, Joe.
Jacob, could you talk a little bit or explain the relationship between your higher self and superconscious mind and how it partakes in intelligent design and synchronicity, if you could explain that?
Well, that's a very loaded question. Wow. You know, you're a very advanced student. No, that's a very loaded question. I mean, you know, for time's sake, it would be hard to get into full entail of it, but I know the superconscious, the higher conscious, I think there's a multitude of levels of that, but, you know, I'm finding that there's just almost an endless degree of parts of ourselves that are, you know, at different rungs and different layers, and how we label it is, you know, it is different, but I think at the end of the day, you know, the way I see it is, you know, we take on these personalities within different lifetimes. Beyond that is a higher expression of who we are and a part of God, and each lifetime is a different experience. And I think a part of us is, you know, almost, you know, incarnated, because in a way, you know, I like what Eli Wiesel would say, God, you know, created man and woman because God loves stories. And I think we're here to have different experiences and different stories. But I think there's a part of us that we connect to within our lifetimes that, you know, has different rungs and different levels of awareness within our higher conscious, you know, subconscious, and superconscious, and they're all just different rungs and different layers of awareness. You know, usually within past life regression, the level that people get on, you know, is usually the higher conscious, the subconscious, but the superconscious is, you know, from my understanding, a pretty high level. It's not a term that I use readily, but from my understanding, that's a very high, you know, part of us of self-actualization. You know, and I think Abraham Maslow, spoke about that, where and that was like the highest fulfillment of someone was just self-actualization and, you know, and awareness. So, you know, that's a very loaded question, but yeah.
Jacob, with everything that you've done over the years with hypnotherapy, what would you say has been the most satisfying aspect of what you do?
I would say empowerment. I think it's, to me, I get very deprived when I give a near-death experience talk, and people get inspired, but it's almost kind of like it's looking at someone at an ivory tower, and they feel very depleted after that, despite a lot of the anecdotal evidence of near-death experiences. And so for me, I want to put the afterlife not monopolized in my hands, but in others' hands. And I think within hypnosis, you're able to really expand consciousness. And you know, I think the good thing is you don't need to die to go to heaven, or you don't need to die to have an awakening. You know, awakening is who you truly are. It's your nature. And I think it's really peeling off a lot of those barriers and those layers. But hypnosis is not just restricted, as, you know, obviously, to past life regression. You know, in a way, it's working with a multitude of areas to stop yourself with what you want to do with the barriers, you know, interplaying within that. And I think 85% of our life, they say, is governed by the subconscious mind. So I think it's really finding ways to make the unaware aware, so that our life, you know, could, so that we could live our life and not life, if that makes sense.
Jacob, I want to thank you for being on the program. Keep in touch with us. And again, can I give out your website, if you would, sir?
Absolutely. So if anyone's interested, my website is jacoblcooper.com, and there you can find my listed services and Life After Breath.
All right, super. Thank you, Jacob. And we've got everything linked up for you at coasttocoastam.com as well. And again, he's on Instagram, he's on Facebook, and it's Jacob L. Cooper. He's breaking up a little bit on the phone there. We've got that linked up at coasttocoastam.com. The name of his book is Life After Breath. It's an amazing story about what happened to him when he was a little boy, 3 years old, when he had his whooping cough near-death experience, which was pretty dramatic. For Michael Cosio, Adam Thompson, Tom Danheiser, Dan Galante, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Ladasur, Stephanie Smith, Chris Boros, Tim Banal, Ryan Stacey, Ian Punnett, and George Knapp. I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.